If you're listening to this podcast, you probably already have an opinion about gun control advocates. But have you ever wondered about what they think about some of their own very large lobby organizations? Welcome back to another episode of T-Rex Talk. And this one we're going to be talking about kind of the gun control industrial complex, because while there are a whole bunch of different people on the left with different political perspectives who all want some different flavors of gun control activism and advocacy has turned into a pretty big monolithic thing with a very cookie cutter approach to changing policy. And I had kind of noticed that, but I hadn't really thought about what that looks like to the folks on the inside. And I need to give a hat tip to the open source defense guys. If you listen to this podcast, you should totally be subscribed to their newsletter. They have a weekly newsletter full of very fascinating things. There's always one main article, but then they include links to other interesting articles, including the one that I'm going to be referencing today. I'm not going to read the whole thing because I don't really have time to go over all of it, but I am going to be quoting from it pretty extensively. It was written by Micah L. Sifri, I believe that's how that's pronounced, and he writes for various organizations and publications like New Republic. He has a book. He's a good writer, and he has some interesting insights, but this article is from his own Substack, and he's talking about why the gun industry, the gun control industry, has turned into kind of this big corporate monolith, and it's a pretty interesting article. I'll link to it down below. And the main thing that I want to talk about in this one is kind of this interesting struggle where you want some level of unity within your people, but that can become this kind of stifling pursuit of uniformity. The left and the right are politically made up of not just, you know, two particular parties, but all kinds of different people and different kinds of lobby groups and interest groups and action groups and grassroots organizations, think tanks, and stuff like that. And if you are a conservative and you've had anything to do with conservative policy or politics or think tanks or whatever, you know that those groups, though they're theoretically kind of on the same side or theoretically inside the same Overton window, fight. I don't want to say they fight like cats and dogs, but I will say that they generally get along about as well as cats and dogs. And part of that is there's just a whole bunch of different people who focus on slightly different issues. So you got your economic freedom people, and they're a little bit different oftentimes from your tax reform people. And then, of course, there's the gun freedom folks. You should be familiar with the spectrum that is in there. You got a bunch of people who want to deregulate agriculture, and then you got your homeschoolers, and then of course you got your pro-life groups, and there are so many different kind of pro-life groups. Like, you have your hardcore abolitionist types, and then you have your people who really just focus on the sidewalk ministry. You got your mainstream evangelical folks, kind of big Eva folks, and they often have fairly large, powerful corporate lobbies like National Rights to Life, and then those are often fairly cozy with the big Catholic groups, but then you also have these really scrappy pre-Vatican II Catholic folks who tend to get along much better with the hardcore abolitionists that we started with. So, you know, you got the idea. And I know that a bunch of conservatives think that things are much more organized on the left and that people get along a lot better. And it certainly seems like they are better coordinated at certain times. But I've also had friends who are leftists tell me, man, it is just a nightmare. Everybody's fighting like cats and dogs in here. We got the Bernie bros, and then we also have these Wall Street hedge fund guys. The L's are fighting with the G's. The greenies want no more nuclear power, and then we got these Muslims who want way more nuclear power, and then Black Lives Matter just championed Hamas in front of our Jewish donors. You guys have it so much easier over there on the right because you just care about God and guns and you agree about everything. So it's definitely one of those grass is always greener on the other side kind of things. But there is one area where I think the left does have tremendous uniformity, not necessarily unity, but there's a lot of uniformity in that gun control lobby. Which isn't to say that there aren't people with widely varied opinions. There are anti-gun folks who are also completely anti-police officer, period. But then there's also anti-gun folks who know that the only way to disarm folks is to have this very large police state. And that's going to somehow protect us so we don't need our personal firearms. But the activism itself that is being done by specific grassroots organizations or lobbyist organizations is pretty centralized and monolithic. So I'm now going to be quoting from Siffre's article on Substack, again linked below. And he's describing a situation that happened after 2013. There was a significant push for gun control legislation, and it didn't really happen. And Joe Biden said to the lobbyists, no, this is actually a good thing. The fact that you have failed in this particular push means that you can now grow a movement. Well, that was 2013, and the article that he wrote is from 2022. Right, he wrote it right after Uvalde, so it is about 18 months old. And he begins this article basically after an introductory paragraph. After so many mass shootings and individual gun deaths, we still don't have a movement. We have a well-financed gun safety lobby that is pursuing common sense gun reform and responsible gun ownership and gun violence prevention, the goals that Every Town for Gun Safety, the biggest gun sense group, emphasizes. But why don't we have a movement? That is the question I want to wrestle with in this issue of The Connector. Instead of writing another piece about why the National Rifle Association and Gun Owners of America are so powerful, or the roots of American gun culture in toxic masculinity and racism, or how some common sense reforms won't really get at the heart of the problem, I want to ponder the part of the mass shooting cycle that gets glossed over. What happens when outrage gets channeled into activism, and specifically why that part of the process seems to be stuck? Unlike many other causes that people are fighting for in America, the struggle for a saner set of gun laws has no diversity of tactics. It is a monoculture, one that's gotten very good at converting outrage into requests for money that keep organizations going, while the problem they claim to be solving gets worse. And yet, like the other parts of the gun crisis cycle, nothing in the advocacy space changes. Why? We should look hard at this question, because when change organizations keep making promises and failing to deliver, they add to the cynicism that already permeates our society, that it's not worth trying to push for anything because nothing will change. And I think this is well noted. Obviously, we're going to have a little bit of a disagreement, he and I, between what saner gun laws would potentially actually look like. And I would love to know what he believes the heart of the problem is. And we could probably have an interesting conversation about toxic masculinity and so forth. But I think that his grasp of the way that gun activism works in the United States is excellent. And the strategy of the activist is really really simple and straightforward, and it is always the same. You wait until there's some sort of tragedy and emotion is really high, and then you use that emotion and the fact that the tragedy is major, major news to get yourself on camera and in the headlines. And then you demand stuff, and then you get turned down, and you get to play the victim card, and you get to ask for more money to get stuff to change, and so forth. And he points out in his article a number of reasons why that uniformity is there. And one of them is a really heavy emphasis on trusting the experts who have come up with this strategy. And part of the reason that this strategy works, this strategy actually is extremely effective for certain people. It's not very effective for people who legitimately want gun laws to change, but it is a really good strategy for people who want to raise money. And it's also a pretty good strategy for Democratic lawmakers, because when you point out that gun laws are not changing, one of the main things that they point to is we need to vote harder. And it's always voting for a specific ideology of candidate, which always ends up being, you know, basically a single party. So this strategy, this particular uniform idea of how you go about gun activism is very beneficial to fundraisers, and it's very beneficial to people running for Democratic office, but not so much for other folks. The other thing that it's really good for is the experts who get trusted. And to be fair, some of these strategies have gotten significant gun laws in certain places, like Washington State and Oregon State got pretty good, strong, heavy authoritarian gun control recently, but it wasn't so much because of these guys in particular. This is just the mentality. This is the worldview that exists in the politicians that were going to be elected there anyway. In the same way that you have really strong authoritarian gun control in California and in New York. But the assumption is that, hey, we're making this thing happen. And the strategies that are working in California, New York, Washington State, et cetera, those are the same strategies that we're going to apply in Tennessee. And that isn't exactly the case. The culture is pretty different between those different states. And having one set of national gun control activist strategists for every single location is just pragmatically a bad idea. Well, I'm going to read another quote from Cifre about how he sees the strategy. He says, "When media attention fades, as it will, this lobby has no plans to create attention on its own beyond vote harder. Once again, it is taking what critic Gary Jung called the empathetic shortcut of focusing on the most innocent of victims to rally pressure on Congress instead of figuring out and then doing the work of building deep connections with the communities most affected by daily gun violence. Nor is there any talk of creatively disrupting gun shows or snarling the checkout lanes at retailers who sell guns. Moms demand action. Don't do mom cots anymore." So, I have read a little bit more of this guy's stuff. I'm not 100% sure what his ideal scenario would be, but he points out the kind of action versus activism that was, there was a little bit more of that in the past. These kind of boycotts, and they're more than just boycotts. They are actually creating confusion and difficulty. A good example of this is Saul Alinsky organized boycotts of specific stores back in the 60s. But it wasn't just that people stopped shopping there. It was that people would go there, fill their carts up with stuff, and then refuse to pay for it and leave. And I think that is something that Moms Demand Action was doing back in the past. And Saul Alinsky's guys went even further. They would order a whole bunch of furniture from these furniture stores, cash on delivery. And then after the furniture arrived at their doorstep, they would say, "No, we don't want it. We refuse it." And that puts a lot of pressure on stores. It isn't just not giving them your business. It is causing them pain and financial damages at some level. That is the kind of activism that's being discussed here. And we'll talk more about boycotts in a little bit, because there is a great deal of confusion over what boycotts are and whether they work or not. People were very loudly proclaiming boycotts not to work, but occasionally they absolutely do. Like when Budweiser did that thing earlier with Bud Light and that one particular trans person, and then nobody wanted to drink Bud Light anymore. And it wasn't just that the boycott affected Bud Light. Anheuser-Busch stock value dropped precipitously. It was very effective. And the main point here is that you need something more than just uniformity. When you uniformly tell a group of people to buy X or to not buy Y, they're only going to be, you know, so much on board with that particular strategy. When people personally, genuinely believe that they want to support company X or that they do not want to be seen drinking beer Y, that is when the boycotts work really well. And just the simple voting with your dollars thing is very effective, and you don't need to do the extra tactic of going out and trying to physically harm and cause some sort of damage to the company by messing with their checkout lines, making it impossible for other people to shop at Walmart simply because you disagree with the stuff that they have inside of their sporting goods section. The second point that Cifre brings up, which is the main one that I really want to get to here, is the fact that the gun organizations, and not all of them, but a couple of gun organizations get massive amounts of money from Michael Bloomberg. Another quote from the article: "Since 2014, the gun control lobby has essentially been rolled up under one roof, Every Town for Gun Safety, with deep backing from one key founder, Michael Bloomberg, one of the world's richest men. After the failure of the Manchin-Toomey bill in the Senate in 2013, which prompted Biden's silver lining comment to givers." This is the one that I mentioned at the beginning. He said, "Don't worry, this failure actually helps you build a movement." Bloomberg entered the gun control space in a big way. After funding his Mayors Against Illegal Guns group for years, he announced a $50 million initiative to counter the power of the National Rifle Association, and he placed a formal mayoral aide of his, John Feinblatt, at its helm. Moms Demand Action, which Shannon Watts had started on an impulse as a Facebook group, was absorbed under Everytown's umbrella, allowing it to claim an instant army of millions of digital activists. And Everytown is the game in town. There's a bunch of other groups that are out there for sure. But in 2020, they raised way more money than every other gun control group combined. Another quote from the article, a Bloomberg spokesman told the New York Times in 2020 that he had given the gun control movement $270 million overall since 2007. Everytown, which does not have to disclose its donors, told the Times that he's responsible for about one-third of its budget. Either way, he is the big kahuna, and it's his politics that the organization reflects, a commitment to bipartisanship and quiet collaboration with the police. And it mentions a few other things here. This is a good article to read. It has some decent journalism on sort of where his money is going. He has given a ton of money to Democratic candidates running for various legislative offices, tons of money to Democratic governors, but also to the Sierra Club, places like that, just millions upon millions upon millions of dollars. And he tries to put it into key races, and he tries to give it to specific key issues, as you would expect. But just to finish out this paragraph, it says, and the Times noted, with his backing, the creation of Everytown came a stark shift in culture and a rigid new command structure, one that left some activists feeling that they were pawns in matching red t-shirts, forced to communicate exclusively in canned talking points. And this is one of the downsides of a kind of an external uniformity. If you don't like all these little different gun groups kind of squabbling with each other over the best ways to do things, money is a real easy way to do this. Everyone who is willing to follow the party line in exchange for money gets a paycheck, and everyone who isn't gets kind of squeezed out. If you have enough millions of dollars, you can get instant external uniformity and instant people lined up in lockstep behind your particular strategy. And it should be noted that Bloomberg set this whole thing up basically to counter the NRA. And I want to give Sifre some props. Earlier on in the beginning of the article that I quoted, he mentioned NRA and Gun Owners of America. And I just want to say kudos to Michael Sifre for knowing that the Gun Owners of America exists, because an awful lot of people who talk about right-wing lobbyists believe that every single thing is run by the NRA, that the NRA controls all the Republicans and all the gun companies. And Bloomberg seems to kind of agree with this, because he created this massively overfunded Everytown and absorbed all the other groups specifically to fight against this kind of imaginary NRA, the one that is also a mammoth, monolithic, single-minded entity. But you guys know that that's not really how the Second Amendment community works. You've got the National Association for Gun Rights, you've got the Second Amendment Foundation, you've got Firearm Policy Center, and then every state has at least one state organization. Then there are other lobbyists who are out there. There are litigators fighting stuff at different court levels. There are educators and historians and scholars doing the research to back these things. And then there are several businesses like T-Rex Arms. We're not the only one to hire our own lobbyists to do our own thing, kind of independent of specific lobby groups. So, yeah, this vast diversity inside of the gun freedom space has some strengths and it has some weaknesses. There is a cost to having this level of decentralization. There is some fighting over territory. There are some counterproductive strategies for sure. There is a little bit of squabbling over the money that's coming from some of the same donors. And there's just a lot of arguing online and elsewhere about different territory and strategy. But, you know, there still is some significant value to that level of decentralization and the different diversity of strategies. And these different gun groups can go after money and ideas and support from folks who might not support the others. And if you contrast that with Everytown, you got to understand that not only is it a single organization, but it is essentially owned by a single guy. He hires all of the experts. And since, you know, those experts are working for the biggest and the richest group, the assumption is the experts must be worth it. So he ends up having a gigantic influence on this organization that he provides a massive, massive amount of funding to. But he also provides a huge amount of influence over every group that would like to get some of his money. And groups that look around and see how big and powerful Everytown is and assume that their strategy must be the winning one or the one that is worth following. So all these small groups kind of imitate the Everytown strategy because it is the one that they see on New York Times headlines and the ones that they see on the major networks. And it is the one that they see getting the most attention from Hollywood and the most money from wealthy folks. And in addition to that trend, just sort of pulling everybody on board with this same really kind of stagnant strategy, what it also does is it attracts a lot of really pragmatic people as opposed to principled people. I mean, there are principled people in the gun control movement, people who believe in principle over pragmatism. They just have different principles, wrong principles, I would say. But let's not overlook the fact that Everytown, in addition to influencing all these other gun orgs, also swallows a bunch of them up, just engulfs them. Here's another quote from Sifre. He says, "Everytown is the only organization I've ever encountered that asks its volunteers to sign a legal volunteer agreement that binds them to confidentiality and a promise not to publicly disparage it and gags them from speaking about it publicly without prior approval." So as they adopt these various other groups, they kind of swallow up all of the mailing lists, all of the networks, and then anyone who volunteers or works with Everytown or with Moms Demand Action or with Youth Demands Action or with any of the other kind of tentacles, they have to sign these documents and they get pulled into this larger database. And I would say that that's, you know, troubling enough when it comes to just regular volunteers. But it's also very heartbreaking when it comes to victims. So here's another quote from Sifre's article talking about Delaney Tarr, one of the original founders of March for Our Lives. March for Our Lives was founded, well, obviously, by a whole bunch of political strategists and advocacy folks and lawyers, and they got money from George Clooney and money from Michael Bloomberg and other people. But ostensibly, March for Our Lives was started, or at least it congealed around survivors of the Parkland shooting. And Delaney Tarr, one of the original founders of March for Our Lives, reflected on her experience last year in an article titled "The Life Cycle of a Youth Activist." In it, she talked about being thrust too quickly into the spotlight, expected to be an expert on an issue that she was just learning, and wooed by everyone under the sun. She calls it the youth activism industrial complex, or what happens at the unique intersection of the traumatized teen activist and the nonprofit industrial complex. She writes, "The youth activism industrial complex takes the teeth out of social movements. Deeply hurt teenagers will organize, but the moment they're picked up by the public, the world becomes a whirlwind of attention. Brand deal offers and media requests will fly by the young activists, and soon enough they will become another cog in the nonprofit regime. The youth activism industrial complex has become a revolving door for passionate teens who want to make a difference. I experienced it at 17 years old, freshly traumatized and avoiding my grief. I listened to the people who told me that I could change the world if I just spoke at their event." And I think that if you think about this, you can think of a number of examples of this in so many different ways. Greta Thunberg being the poster child of the Green Movement when she was really too young to even know that she was being used is a good example. But there are countless examples. And the survivors of school shootings are a perfect pool of victims for this kind of big monolithic entity that desperately needs the emotion, the sorrow and the pain and the sadness of other people to fuel its own goals, which, as Sifre points out, its own goals are theoretically to change gun laws, but man, they're basically whatever Michael Bloomberg's ideas are. And sometimes his ideas are really, you know, how to get the next Democratic governor elected in Georgia or Virginia. But it isn't always that manipulative and Machiavellian. I think that the left also suffers from this desire to swallow up as many people as possible in their groups and their organizations because they have to have many voices. They have to have this very, very big group all speaking because of this belief in blind democracy. The voice of the majority is the correct voice. If enough people want something, it is morally correct. Vox populi, vox dei, that kind of thing. Essentially, what they're saying is might makes right. The majority rules. And David Hogg actually kind of mentioned this a little bit accidentally in a Twitter post from last month. Oh, by the way, David Hogg, we've talked about before, Michael Cifre admits that he is the only member of March for Our Lives who is still active in politics and desperately wants to be elected congressman as soon as he's 25 years old and old enough to run. But he mentioned in this post, after posting some pictures of himself with a break-action shotgun, he wrote, "I got back on the range today. Half of the time I think that I trigger many conservatives is because they cannot say that they speak for all people who use guns or own them." I think he's kind of missing the point there a little bit. I have never actually talked to any gun freedom advocates who claim to speak for all gun owners or who even see that as a helpful, beneficial thing. But on the left, there is this idea that we will have unity. We will have more clout if we have more numbers. If we can speak for large groups of people, then we are going to be somehow more morally correct and have the power to get our way. But people who are not obsessed with just blind democracy and majority rule don't care about that. You can be morally right without being in the majority and without caring about majority opinion. If you truly care what is right, then the truth is all that matters. If I were the only person on the face of the earth who was saying that humans have the right to defend the sanctity of life, then I would still say it. This conviction that people are made in the image of God and can use lethal force to prevent murder doesn't need democratic support. It doesn't need strength of numbers, and it doesn't need might to make it right. Now, there are thousands of years of theological study and political theory that do support this position that I see in Scripture, but the support is just verification. It's not justification. And this is how you build true unity, not just external uniformity, but unity comes when you have shared convictions. There's drama in the Second Amendment community, sure, but the shared values, if they are core values, can actually build strength on that diversity of strategy. And the more fundamental, the more basic those moral values are, then the better the unity will be. The drama will get more minor and less of a big deal, and you'll get a lot more actual power from, and I don't mean political power, but more actual unity coming out of these different, diverse, decentralized groups with shared fundamental values. So much better than the external uniformity of being paid to stick to a particular party line and the canned responses. And there's another thing, too. The left complains about this all the time. They say that Republicans in particular and conservatives kind of in general and, oh, definitely Christians are trapped in this sort of echo chamber where they cannot do critical thinking. They cannot really think outside of these sort of external prescribed things. And I want to push back against that a little bit, but I also want to talk about another quote from Cifre. And even though he's not part of the Bloomberg machine, even though he's not part of that large monoculture that he's describing really accurately, he is still part of a different type of monoculture. He is so fixated on the need for public disarmament in the United States that he is missing some points. That uniformity to that idea that guns are just bad, has left him kind of unable to do a little bit of critical thinking. And I will read another quote that I think sort of supports this. He says, "There is furious anger across America right now at the senseless slaying of 19 fourth graders and two teachers at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, on top of the racist massacre in Buffalo 10 days earlier. In the first days after the nightmare, people were ready to go to the streets to stop business as usual until the Senate, which is the main bulwark of the gun lobby, acts to do some obvious things like ban the purchase and ownership of the AR-15 assault weapons." So he is 100% right. Again, this was about 18 months ago. He was 100% right that at that time, after the Uvalde shooting especially, there was furious anger in America. It was extremely widespread. But he is wrong in assuming that all of that anger was focused on the AR-15 or any other particular firearm. Most Americans were furious at the murderer, but they were also furious at the circumstances surrounding, well, technically both of those shootings. The Buffalo shooting was perpetrated by a guy who chose a really soft target, and the people of Buffalo, New York, were unable to defend themselves because of the draconian anti-gun ownership policies of that particular state. And then the Uvalde, Texas situation is even more tragic and infuriating. Even though Texans are allowed to own and carry firearms, the local police department prevented people from defending their own children and wives by keeping them out of the building, stopping them from doing what was morally right, and waiting for over an hour. If you think very critically about these two situations and what could have made the body count lower, the answer is not to have a better armed police state and a less armed public. The answer is clearly not to have more failed gun laws that do absolutely nothing to prevent violent criminals from committing murder. And Cifra even points out that the cops are holding regular people back. He says here, like the Uvalde cops who held back the mothers and fathers of those kids as the shooter rampaged, the professional do-gooders at the big anti-gun violence groups also swung into action, seeking to hold back our fury and channel it into the same safe and limited channels they've been using for years to lead the charge for better gun laws. I don't know if that is how widespread that is actually true. I don't know how many anti-gun people were ready to swing into action in every town, and moms demand action. Other people were like, ahem, hey now, just put on your red t-shirt and show up at the rallies that we tell you to. Most of the people in the United States who were infuriated by that were not actually looking for more gun legislation. In fact, you can look at the gun sales after that event. You can see the spike in people purchasing firearms because their main takeaway from that event was not that they wanted more police protection, but that they wanted more personal self-defense capacity. But Cifre doesn't get that, and a whole lot of gun control advocates don't really get that. And I think that there is a real danger of echo chambers, obviously, and baking people into uniformity that isn't based on fundamental moral principles is an issue. It leaves them with tremendous blind spots. You get people who can stay on message, but they can't actually adapt or grow or understand or build or change tactics as the situations around them change, regardless of what we're talking about, whether it is, you know, political action or actual action. And when you have people who are just sort of sticking to the message, to be honest, you can't even trust those people to stick to that message if they're only doing it for the message's stake. That is why Bloomberg pays them so well. They stick to the message for their paycheck's stake. That is why, going back to boycotts, some boycotts work and some boycotts don't. If you are part of some kind of political action group and you were told not to shop at a place that has stuff that you really like, you will do whatever you want. But if you personally have deep principled convictions about issues, you find out that a company is either rock solid on board with those principles that you care about or diametrically opposed to them, you will genuinely want to support that business and have their products, or you will genuinely want to not give them your money and no longer consume such and such product. So we're going to close out the episode with a very common T-Rex talk refrain, which is you need a moral framework, a fundamental moral standard. You need principles that are systematic and unchanging that give you the direction on these things. And you know where I believe that has to come from. The transcendent word of God. But whether you agree with that source or not, I think we can all agree that you can't get a foundational, systematic, fundamental, comprehensive moral framework merely by getting a paycheck from Michael Bloomberg.